evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Bullet Sidebar. This is your host, Jeff Horn, talking all things New Jersey Supreme Court. We have some exciting news in New Jersey Supreme Court land. We've got two nominees that are moving through the political process. Rachel Wehner Apter, you'll recall, was nominated a year and a half ago or so and is back moving with senatorial courtesy block been dealt with. And we also have Appellate Division Judge Douglas Fischali. His nomination is moving. So we have one Democrat, one Republican moving through the process. So we can fill two slots that are now held by senior Appellate Division judges, Fuentes, Fisher, and Sabatino, all, by the way, and Fischali as well, all, by the way, well-regarded, big-brain judges, but they are also close to the door. They're close to age 70. I think Judge, or maybe Joe Fischetti is with me, will know this better than I, but I believe Judge Fisher is very close to mandatory retirement. So the stopgap that Chief Justice Ravner put in is going to unravel as the judges retire out. So hopefully the Senate can get our nominees through and fill the court. So I teased already who's with me today is Joseph Fischetti. He's been on the program before earlier this year, and he does a magnificent job of breaking down the statistics for the court. If I claim that the Bold Sidebar is talking all things New Jersey Supreme Court, but without any sanction or recognition by the court whatsoever, I'm completely on my own when it comes to anyone approving what we're doing. Same goes for Joe. Joe puts together a fantastic statistical package. We talked about last year's. He's really upgraded it. It's really reader-friendly and chock full of interesting stuff, and he's added more sections. So with that, I'm going to say good afternoon, Joe Fischetti.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me back.
My absolute pleasure. And we'll just do a little bio stuff. Don't let me miss anything. Of course, you were a clerk for Chief Justice Ravner. Then you moved over, and I'm blanking on the judge, maybe Judge Hayden in the Federal District Court. Okay. Of course, spouse of Joe Hayden, who's been on the podcast a number of times, and Lowenstein firm for a bunch of years. And now you've made a career move in the last few months since we spoke. What's going on now?
I have. So I am about 5 months into a term as Assistant General Counsel at Valley Health System, based out of Paramus. So we have the Valley Hospital and some affiliated entities within the health system. And so it's an exciting change for me and an exciting organization to be a part of.
Yeah, you really tantalized me when we were talking, and this has nothing to do with the Supreme Court, but it's of interest to people who care about things happening in New Jersey, is that after, I don't know, the last 20, 30 years, you only heard of hospitals closing, consolidating, big hospital systems buying up smaller hospitals, et cetera, that there is a hospital under construction or to be constructed in New Jersey.
Yes. So Valley is currently based out of Ridgewood, but they're in the process of building a brand new hospital in Paramus. And the goal right now, last I heard, is to open for its first patient in December of 2023. So that brings plenty of exciting legal challenges on our end as well to new endeavors. And it's an exciting time to be here.
Oh, I'm sure. And that's really interesting. And it's funny, again, off track, but hospital business being what it is, every hospital I've ever been in is there's one building and then there's an addition that doesn't quite exactly line up. And then there's another addition that's below or above or around. And you see piping going everywhere, and you see utilities running everywhere, and elevators, and it's quite easy to get lost in our hospital as they've been built in modules when demand and money lined up to create the buildings. And now there's going to be a brand new building, which will not suffer, hopefully not very soon, but will not suffer that sort of confusing bunch of engineering, architecting, and movement around hospitals.
It's funny that my office is in an offsite office park, so I'm not in the hospital itself. But on the occasion when I do actually have to go to the hospital, I find myself wandering around a little bit, trying to find my way to which building I'm supposed to go to, even though I've worked here for several months. So, hopefully with the new hospital, that won't be an issue, or at the very least, I won't be alone in trying to find my way.
it's a good point. So, Joe, you broke down the what we'll call 2021 to 2022 term. So the term that ended on June 30, 2022. That's what we're talking about now, right?
Yeah. So I think that they wrapped up arguments in May and wrapped up opinions in late August, shortly before Judge Fuentes retired.
Right. Exactly. So we call it a June 30 term, but some of the opinions that dropped this summer, a number of them that dropped this summer, trail back to the prior term, essentially.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's dig right in to your first slide. How I look at this, it's slide like, but it's also presented in a flow, makes it very easy for the reader. Majority opinions, first half. Majority opinions, second half.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's helpful about this project for me is that as you go along, and these two pages kind of create almost a timeline of who wrote which opinions from which sitting, and it gives you a sense of the workflow and the division of labor over the course of the term. There were, you know, later I'll be talking about the Crystal Point opinion, and something that was interesting that happened there is that a friend of mine was representing an amicus in that case, and I was able to tell her ahead of time who was going to be writing the opinion, because I was able to deduce from what was going on that it was with other cases that it was going to be a Patterson opinion. Almost
interesting.
And yeah, and the timeline is interesting this term, because I think he almost had. I don't know that the court will ever see another term like this, and I hope it doesn't, in the sense that it was very fragmented. You almost had four different courts. You started out the first 4 months with the same court as there was last year, with Justices LaVecchia and Fernandez-Vigna. Then you have a month and a half with Judge Fuentes in for LaVecchia, and Fernandez-Vigna still in. And then you have Fernandez-Vigna retire, and you have the six-member court with Judge Fuentes on temporary assignment. And then, you know, the last two-ish months after Justice Albin retired, you just have the bare quorum five-member court. So it led to just a very fragmented phase. I think one issue that I noticed this year that we may touch on later as well is that divided decisions actually came out more quickly this term than unanimous decisions. And it's usually going to be the opposite. It usually takes more time if you have a dissent, because, you know, it takes time to write the dissent and the majority will often respond to it. But this term, it was actually a little bit faster in divided opinions. And I think that's because they were losing justices so quickly that they needed to get those divided decisions released, lest it change the results or cost a quorum.
Very interesting. We didn't have, after the Ludzinski case that to me dominated the news of the court last year, we didn't have cases that had to come back up for re-argument. As Ludzinski was in front of the court twice because of the application made by the defense to have a judge brought up.
Right. The only time that was because of the tie caused by Chief Justice Ravner's recusal. I think only time there was something like that otherwise that happened this term is that there was one case, I can't recall which it was, in which I believe it was argued with a bare quorum of five justices prior to Fernandez-Vigna's retirement. And I think they ended up having to call up Judge Fisher to sit in, even though he wasn't there for argument. I suspect they were trying to get that one out before the retirement, and it just didn't work out. But otherwise, as far as I could tell, they didn't have to reschedule anything. That they were, I'm sure it had to be very frantic on the court, but they got it all done.
I'm sure. I mean, these past couple of years have been absolutely frantic by the court, as the court, in my way of thinking, revamped the trial courts, how we do our day-to-day job, how I do my day-to-day job is completely revamped, and handled a bunch of heavyweight issues, a bunch of heavyweight cases at the same time. And as you say, scrambled around going, who's sitting next to me today at argument? Who are you?
Exactly.
So anything else about the split between the first term and the second, or first half of the term, second half of the term, how you broke that down?
I think those are the major points there. It did seem to be a little bit of a lighter docketed term than usual. So I think they may have managed expectations at the back end so that they wouldn't have to rush in getting opinions out.
Yeah. I mean, the court certainly chunks out opinions, right? There'll be several weeks, a month even, where there's no opinions, and then they just come flying out. You know, six will come out in a row. Six heavy-duty opinions will come out. I did double-check your report from last year and this year, and there were fewer opinions generated in the year, you know, the term closing June 30, 2022, about 60 opinions, 74 opinions the prior year. I don't know how they did that. I really don't know how they did that. Well, I guess you had a little more stability in the membership, even though they had a lot of other issues on the agenda. So, all right, let's keep on going. I've teased the slight composition of the court's docket when I was counting up the opinions that were generated this term.
Yeah, so the one thing that was much more conventional about this term than last term is that last term, in part because of COVID, but also because of just some quirky procedural postures, that cases got to the court in a lot of odd ways last year, you know, such as appeals from a decision on the Advisory Committee on Professional Ethics, which is technically appealable directly to the Supreme Court on petition. This year, everything was kind of the standard ways things get to the court. 80% certification to the appellate division, and then there were five motions for leave to appeal and six appellate division dissents. So kind of the three main ways you would normally expect to see a case get to the Supreme Court. And the court, as usual, had a little bit over half its docket was criminal. I think that's standard. The cert petitions are usually overwhelmingly criminal. So it bears out that the argued cases end up more criminal than civil as well.
Right, right. And we've got a slide, outcomes by vote split.
Yeah, and we had this term, I think, was a little bit more unanimous than last term, actually. Last term, I think, was in the high 70% unanimity. This term, we're at 80%. Decisions were unanimous. What is different is, you know, what unanimous went, whereas last term, that usually meant 7-0. This term, 40% of cases were decided with just five justices, which by rule is the fewest number you can have. Even though four is a majority, you need five sitting to decide a case. And so only fewer than 20% of cases were decided with seven justices this term.
Yeah, that's striking. And hopefully the wheels of wheels in Trenton will make sure that doesn't happen again. Justice Albin, now retired in July, to hitting what Justice O'Hearn called in his book constitutional senility, I think is his term.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah, age of 70. But he went down swinging hard. He generated the most opinions in the term, kind of as usual, I would assess.
I mean, one thing that is difficult to overstate is Albin's propensity as a workhorse. I mean, and I think he said in an interview after his retirement that he basically, this term, you know, he retired in early July, and he said he really just did 12 months of work in 10 months. It shows, really. I mean, you know, he had two concurring opinions and five dissents, and that's more than any other justice had for either of those. And I recall one matter in particular where he had a concurring opinion very close to his retirement on a very kind of minute and peculiar kind of nitpicking procedural point. And I remember thinking that's kind of classic Albin. Just, you know, a lot of justices might have said it's not going to change the outcome. It's just a concurring opinion. Why bother? But of course, he's going to write on it.
Oh yeah, I don't know Justice Albin person, but I don't think he ever says why bother. I don't think
exactly.
Once it's in his mind, you get the sense it's not going to be worked out until he writes on it.
Yeah, and I think that it'll be interesting to see the court without him. You know, this will be, he's had 20 terms there, and he has always been outspoken and always the most vociferous dissenter and an active, you know, it's not enough to vote for him. He is an active voice on and for the court. And I think it will be interesting to, you know, I could easily see someone like Rachel Wehner after, you know, taking the baton on that type of point, but it will be, Albin was unique on the court in how he approached things. And it'll be interesting to see the court without him as it unfolds this coming term.
I don't know if this is true or if this is an urban legend, but the legend is that, and you don't have to reveal this, I'm not asking you to reveal any Supreme Court secrets that you've been pledged to keep, that there is a fine for the first justice that interrupts the appellant attorney's argument and or does so within the first 3 minutes or 5 minutes, and maybe it's a $20 fine or something like that. And then there's a party funded by the fines collected, and that Justice Albin, in addition to writing the most opinions, the most dissents, was also apt to fund the party. I don't know if you know about that.
I had not heard that, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's true.
Okay, very good.
He is a presence in oral argument as well, not just in his writing.
Absolutely, he was always quick to jump in. I think that I don't think I'm revealing a confidence. I believe that Judge Cuff, Mary Catherine Cuff, who served the longest as a non-nominated justice, served as the senior active judge for almost 4 years on the court. I believe she confirmed the existence of that fine system and the likelihood that Justice Albin, during her time, had been the greatest funder of the party. I'll have to circle back with her. Moving on in the same light to the decisions by author, you want to speak to this slide?
Sure. So I think, you know, this is a little bit of a different way of listing the timeline and, you know, sorting out who wrote opinions and what type of opinions in what case. And, you know, that there are always idiosyncrasies to each term that make my project here difficult. And State versus Lizinski was the challenge this time because it featured a joint dissent that I suspect was mostly written by Justice Patterson, but it was jointly signed by Patterson, Fernandez-Vina, and Solomon. And one interesting shift this term is that Justice Solomon was in the majority more than any other justice last term. But this term, he actually, next to Justice Albin, ended up writing the greatest number of dissents. And there was a little bit of a shift in outcomes on criminal cases that I think led to that to some extent. But I think that that was the most interesting thing. I think it is notable that there were very few in general, you know, concurring and dissenting opinions this term. And I think that may have reflected the court's urgency in trying to resolve cases as it was losing members.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. And you had mentioned earlier the kind of spread, in other words, how many cases are not unanimous. I guess if I was just purely an outside, I would think there was tons of cases that were not unanimous, and everybody on the court is just fighting for their position, and, you know, just sort of how partisan politics are and media is. It's like everyone's got to get their last word, and it's really not the case. Just look at your next slide about, you know, the frequency of justices in the majority, and, you know, they all are heavy hitters.
Yeah, even, you know, I think if you go by, if you're looking at all cases, Justice Fernandez-Vina was the justice least often in the majority of this term, and he was in the majority 84% of the time. So it is a, you know, this is a court that has historically operated, if not by unanimity, certainly with a great deal of collegiality and respect for one another. And I think it does a good service to the bar and to the rule of law to have the court so frequently able to speak with one voice and with, you know, respectful dissent when it's not speaking with one voice.
Yeah, agreed. I don't believe it's the doing of the U.S. Supreme Court justices, but certainly it doesn't appear that way. It appears from the outside, from the media perspective, that it's a horse race mentality and the quest to get to enough votes and kind of stick it to the other side. I'm sure the justices never look at it like that at all. But we don't even suffer that in terms of media coverage in New Jersey. I never get the sense from the media they're trying to stoke some conflict in the public among the justices.
No, it's certainly not. It's a notable contrast, and one that I think it's unfortunate has become a little bit more apparent in recent years. I think the U.S. Supreme Court used to actually have somewhat similar numbers of unanimity. Most of their cases were decided unanimously not that long ago, and I think it dropped to about 20 or 30% in the last term. And so, you know, there was always a little bit of a divide in if you were comparing the U.S. Supreme Court to New Jersey Supreme Court, but it's become a little more stark here. I'll sometimes look at I'll look at this and I will sometimes say that, you know, Chief Justice Ravner and Justice LaVecchia were in the last two terms have been what I would call the swing justices, but that's not really a fair way to depict it because it's so few cases that really turn on one justice's vote that it's statistically not all that significant.
Yeah, no, agreed. And, even when I look at your divided cases, how you broke that down, who's the majority, and Justice Fernandez Vina is at the 25% mark, but we're only talking about four cases.
Right. Fernandez Vina participated in four divided cases this term, and it was only the majority on one. So sample size is always an issue when you're looking at these kinds of numbers.
For sure. It's almost meaningless when you're talking about four cases across 60 or 70 per year in terms of the decisions produced by the court. All right. Creeping over to the next page, the cases with two plus dissenting votes. You already mentioned the Ledzinski case, and for anyone who hasn't listened to me pratter on about that on and on. I mean, I must have done four or five of the shows where I mentioned the Ledzinski case. Also, I called it the disappearance of Timothy Wiltsie case. So there's lots to talk about there, but it's not really part of today's mission other than to point out that was one of the cases where there were multiple dissents.
Right. And I think one to the extent that you can come up with voting blocks, and it's easy to overstate this, so I want to stick a pin in that for a second. But to the extent you can see voting blocks, civil cases can be a little bit all over the place, and tough to, you know, dissent there can often be idiosyncratic and not ideological in the sense that people generally think about it. Criminal cases is where you could more often see both this term and last term of a block of Justice Albin, Pierre-Louis, and sometimes LaVecchia, sometimes Ravner, this term Fuentes, often siding with criminal defendants, while Justices Solomon, Patterson, and Fernandez-Vina sided with the state in criminal cases. The pin that I stick in that is that, again, we're talking about five cases out of 30 criminal cases. And so, right. I hesitate to call it a voting block because it's, 24 out of the 29 criminal cases were unanimous. So I don't want to overemphasize the point, but that is one area where you can see a little bit of a voting block. And I think, it's a tradition in the Supreme Court that at their last sitting before a justice retires, they all have a brief farewell speech, and they post those. It's still available on the court's website. And Justice Pierre-Louis kind of alluded to that when she was speaking at Justice Albin's farewell, the two of them often kind of joining together in dissent in those divided cases. But this term, they were more often the majority.
With those very few, really five of the state v cases, criminal cases, where there was two dissents, as you have it here, three went for the defense and two for the state. And one is the Ledzinski case. It's kind of a one in a million, fact pattern. So it doesn't really contribute a ton to our jurisprudence going forward. I mean, it's such an oddball.
It's a very fact-specific case.
Very fact-specific. Zerati, Comer, Goldsmith, the cases dealing with age of defendants and police procedure, I think they're really shaping where police work is going and the state's job is going. And I think those cases are the interesting cases. And we have a couple of those in the pipeline again coming up. We just had the Bookman case. So, those cases, I think, are taking shape. And Bookman was unanimous. So, again, I'm nerding out. No one would know what they're talking about unless you read the book and case. But interesting, and as I always say, probably every third podcast, policy, policy, policy. That's what the court is really writing. Besides meeting out justice to the individual litigants or corporations that are presenting a case, it's policy, policy, policy. All right. The next one, we're dealing with the justice agreement rates. And again, your high-level point is made. The justices are agreeing. I mean, the most hot dispute between two justices is 76% agreement, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And this term was also a little tricky because I think Justice LaVecchia only participated in about 9 decisions, and some of them were hotly contested. But for the most part, this is a court that tends to operate on unanimity. And, you don't see any sharp ideological rivals here.
When people ask me all the time, I'm a trial court lawyer, I'm a family lawyer, they always ask me about appeals. Every week I discuss the potential for an appeal, and very, very few do we take. And I tell clients about 75% of cases that go up on appeal are losers. So you got to know that it's not so easy. But if you get to the New Jersey Supreme Court, your odds are a little better. Let's talk about your judgments analysis.
Yeah, so they're a little bit better, but probably not as good as a lot of people think. Because I recall when I was practicing, I once had a matter where we lost in the appellate division and we petitioned for certification, and the cert was granted, and a partner I was working with was elated and thought this kind of meant, okay, great, the court sees the error in the appellate division's ways and wants to fix it. And I said, I think the more likely outcome here is that the court sees a question that the appellate division addressed that is important enough that it should garner the Supreme Court's attention. And that is really what happened, is that the court reached the same results as the appellate division, but on different grounds, and ultimately affirmed unanimously. And that's what you see in a lot of cases here. 48% of cases that make it for argument before the Supreme Court get reversed. But that means that, a little more than half, even after you fight your way in and get your foot in the door and they agree to hear it, that they still end up siding against you. So it's an incredible accomplishment to win cert, but it is by no certain, it's not a victory in and of itself.
No, I understand. And even, as you're saying, even reversed may not mean what you want it to mean.
Right. It could mean a remand. It could often mean a remand to the appellate division to address issues that were, the court didn't have to reach. And one of the challenges as I'm doing this project is that there is so much nuance that's impossible to capture. And that's part of what happens here, is that, to say that one side, quote unquote, won doesn't necessarily capture the, I believe that there is one case, and I'm blanking on what it was, but it was a criminal case in which the particular defendant lost on the facts. The defendant lost, but the reaction of the amici who were on defendant's side in that was very positive, because the court set a very pro defendant rule down, and they were elated by the big picture outcome, even though the particular defendant in that case lost. And so, on this chart, that shows up as a defendant loss and an affirmance, even though there's much more to the story than that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You got to read these things very closely to see what the real result is and what the real policy impact is going forward. All right, we've talked a bit about the volume. We've talked about the volume of decision makers that we've had this past term. And you have a couple of charts that deal with waiting time and time between argument and decision. You want to talk about those statistics?
Sure. This is, I'm always just curious on the timing of how long these take. And because it's a small sample size, it can vary. But there are always outliers in either direction, cases like Leszczynski that carry on forever before they reach a final disposition. And then there can be very expedited cases that get heard by the appellate division 1 month and then decided by the Supreme Court the next. So this month, overall, you were looking at about 5 to 6 months between an appellate division decision and the Supreme Court deciding to grant cert or a motion for leave to appeal. And then usually about 6 to 7 months between the acceptance of the appeal and the argument. And, you know, the amount of time after argument before a decision comes out can vary tremendously. It's usually around 3 to 4 months. One of the oddities of this term, as I mentioned, was that divided decisions, which usually take longer to write, came out faster this term, I think, because they needed to get those decided to avoid having outcomes change based on retirements.
You added, I think, a very clever analysis of how cases get to the Supreme Court under the next sort of tab, where you're dealing with what was affirmed on opinion below and the appellate division dissents that gave rise to cases that were heard by the court. You want to talk about these couple of slides?
Yeah, I do think that one thing is I always find interesting is the intersection and the interplay between the appellate division and the Supreme Court. And so one thing that happens from time to time, a couple times a term, is that the Supreme Court, rather than issuing a full opinion, will issue a short per curiam opinion, basically saying, we agree substantially with this opinion below and therefore adopt its reasoning. And so that happened three times this term, once a Judge Sabatino decision and twice with Judge Misano decisions, essentially having the court say, we have nothing to add to this and we're not much to add to this and we will adopt that. What didn't happen this term, but that is always, I think, must be great for some appellate division judges, is sometimes the court will adopt the dissent below. And I think that happened twice last term. I think Judge Accurso had two dissents where the court in both of them said that it was adopting her decisions below, which I'm sure, you know, is quite a distinction for them. You know, and another question is that I was curious about is what happens, you know, if an appellate division judge dissents, it creates automatic jurisdiction to the Supreme Court. You don't have to apply for cert, that the court has to take the case. And so this term, there were six of those, and judges Fisher, Rothstadt, and Susswine each had their dissenting views vindicated in the Supreme Court this term. One interesting little fun fact that I looked into that I noticed this is that Judge Fischelli, who is now, you know, sitting on temporary assignment and will presumably be joining the court full time soon, has actually never written a dissenting opinion in his 10 years on the appellate division.
Very interesting. One of the things that jumped out on the slide 17, at the end of the appellate division dissents that went up, right, is that of those six cases, five of them have judges who have sat on the Supreme Court. So you talk about the interplay between the appellate division and the Supreme Court. You've got the intellectual interplay, the decision-making interplay, and then you've got the actual players moving up. Fuentes, who spent a good chunk of time sitting, Judge Fisher, who's going to have a short run, Judge Fischelli, hopefully will have a much longer run. Very interesting. Five of the six involved those judges from the appellate division. All right, you added, and this really caught my attention when you shared this with me, you added a section about the attorneys. And we attorneys love to talk about ourselves, think about ourselves. So you stoked, I'm sure, some interest in who were the attorneys who appeared the most, and not just who are they by name, but their apparent race, their apparent gender, their years on the years as members of the bar. So let's just dig into these, because I think this is really, really interesting.
Yeah, this was a substantial undertaking, because other parts of this project I can do by just looking at the four corners of the Supreme Court's opinions, whereas this one really kind of requires some outside research. But I thought it was something that I was interested in learning about, and I thought, you know, would be helpful for, you know, to assemble the data. The challenge to it is, of course, that it is that there's kind of as much art as there is science there. You know, there's no perfect way to necessarily identify a person's race or gender identity just by their name or the appearance on the court's video. So I had to do some sleuthing in LinkedIn pages and news articles. And, you know, for that reason, I I have all the raw data in a very large spreadsheet, but I decided only to discuss individual names if I was 100% confident in the data that I put together. So I think in the aggregate, it is directionally correct, but it is certainly a best effort rather than something that I can guarantee is precise.
Sure. Well, when you've got 217, did I count it correctly?
I believe that's right.
Or did you call out that number? I don't know why that number is in my head. Maybe it's in the notes. I think 217 yes. different lawyers appeared in front of the New Jersey Supreme Court. So to me, that's a lot.
Yeah. So I think it's 217 appearances. So
right.
Friend of the podcast, Alex Shalom, is about 11 of those. It is a lot to go through.
Yeah. We'll get to that page, but I'll let you walk through it. The demographics of it, as you said, you gave a precise cautionary note at the beginning of the demographic piece that it's based upon your best judgment, and you're not calling anyone out one way or the other unless you specifically know.
Right. So I think overall, if you're looking at all attorneys who argued, including Amici, it is about 90% white and 60% male. And the 90% white really carries across regardless of how you break it down. If you exclude Amici, if you only look at civil cases, if you only look at criminal cases, that kind of carries across all categories. The gender divide is much different in criminal cases, where I believe women are actually a majority of arguing attorneys in criminal cases, and in particular in any matter where the government is arguing, the state entities such as OPD, the attorney general, or county prosecutor's offices are much more likely to have women arguing than men. And I think those were kind of the major takeaways that came from this. One thing that is without naming anyone, just in case I'm not correct about this, but one thing I was very surprised by is that, you know, when you take into account multiple appearances, if you look at actual attorneys, I believe only one Black man and only one Asian woman argued before the Supreme Court in this past term. They each had multiple appearances, so it looks like more than that. But that's kind of the big picture on the race and gender. I also looked at years of admission, which you can find. That's publicly available on the court's website. And government attorneys were significantly younger, or I shouldn't say younger. You don't know the background. It had later years of bar admission than private attorneys. And what was interesting also is that in civil, if you're looking at just parties in civil cases, the attorneys were on average about 15 years more experienced than looking at criminal cases or cases overall. I think the average year of admission for all attorneys who argued was 2000. Criminal cases, that was 2004. I'm sorry, for criminal parties, that was 2004. And for civil parties, it was 1995. And so you're looking at a much more experienced segment of the bar appearing in those civil cases, which is probably not surprising. You know, I think when you have a party in a civil case, you know, that they'll often be looking for a more experienced hand when they're, even if it's just for appearance's sake, when it comes to arguing before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I found this very interesting. And you wonder, you know, when you become a lawyer, how long will it take me to get to argue in front of the Supreme Court? Well, very, very, as I say, 217 appearances, it's not 217 lawyers. Maybe, I don't know, 175 lawyers ballpark, something like that, out of tens of thousands that are licensed in New Jersey. So it's kind of a needle in a haystack, kind of a rather specialized bar in some ways. But then you get over to some of the spread on the attorney years of admission. For example, you've got Joe Hayden, who's been on the podcast multiple times, barred in 1969. And then you've got 1, 2, 3 government attorneys, public defender, attorney general, attorneys with a couple of years of experience.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, especially when I, because I, for a lot of these, I would look up their professional backgrounds just to see whether they were admitted in some other state first. So, you know, there were a couple instances where I found someone who, you know, was listed as admitted New Jersey in 2021, but then I realized they were admitted somewhere else earlier, and I didn't include that. I put their original year of admission as an attorney somewhere rather than here. But, you know, I think you recently discussed the Goldsmith case. The public defender who argued that case was admitted in 2021, and it was, you know, that OPD has some really impressive people when you look at their resumes and their backgrounds and their clerkships working for them there. And I think that seems to be the best place to go if you're looking for early Supreme Court experience in your career.
No doubt about that. That's your path. It's funny. I remember as a law clerk, and was a law clerk dinner with the judges, and it's kind of they're roasting the law clerks of the County Bar Association. And someone was criticizing another lawyer for trying too many cases and saying, if you want to try cases, just join the public defender's office. And it was kind of, to the catcalls of the group of attorneys there. Attorneys with multiple arguments, and this was striking to me, of course, you mentioned Alexander Shalom, who's been on the podcast, and certainly I'll be recruiting him to talk about some cases before 2022, the calendar year runs out, 9 appearances. I forget the numbers. I've counted it up for him before, and he's just been the most prolific attorney, whether it's on the brief or appearing as a couple hundred times over the years already. And then the other second group, besides the ACLU and then the government side, is the Pashman Stein Walter Hayden group, who Justice Stein was kind enough to come on the show, I guess right in the beginning of the pandemic, actually, virtually. And of course, they have an entire Justice Stein, an institute designed to advance public interest and to do pro bono work. So if I counted right, 5 of their attorneys argued multiple cases in front of the court this past term.
Yeah, and their numbers, I didn't pull them specifically, but I do recall that I think they appeared in about, Pashman Stein had someone appearing in about a fifth of oral arguments this term. And I think it was something like 9 different attorneys from that firm appearing, which is really impressive. And I think it also shows that firm's commitment to pro bono appellate work, because they are there all the time and they spread it around to a lot of attorneys there.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, right, as you say, 5 5 attorneys had 2 appearances. We mentioned Joe Haney and 1 appearance. So, yeah. A big commitment and doing tremendous work. And of course, they also have a big case that they've been shepherding to essentially find the New Jersey education system discriminatory and unconstitutional. So I don't know where that is right now, but that's been waging for a couple of years. So they're doing a tremendous amount of work. You want to talk about the Amici, of course. We have ACLU, Alexander.
Yes, the ACLU was present in 20 cases this term. The number that I found most surprising is the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in New Jersey, more often than not represented by Pashman Stein, to connect it back, appeared in 23 cases. And I believe there were 29 criminal cases overall. So they, you know, the ACDL is, you know, making certain that its voice is known, which, given that the Attorney General appears quite often as well, it should come as no surprise that, you know, that they want to, the Attorney General also appears in civil cases from time to time, but I think it's no surprise that the ACDL wanted to have a counterbalance on the amicus front.
Yeah. And speaking of Joe Haden, Joe, I believe, was the first president of that organization going back certainly 40 years ago, maybe even a little bit longer. And it's an organization of the Criminal Defense Bar, who volunteers their time and puts in obviously a tremendous amount of work and writing briefs, assessing which cases to jump into, writing briefs and appearing. This past term aside, we've had a lot of stability in the New Jersey Supreme Court overall. Chief justices have served a bunch of years typically, and you've studied the historical, or you've created a historical building block. Justices in order of duration of service, And we just had two justices leave who were on the court for a long time.
Yeah, Justice LaVecchia had, she was just about 2 months shy of 22 years on the court. She finished as the third overall justice in the court's 75-year history in duration of service. If she had served to her to the age of constitutional senility at 70, she would have been the longest serving justice in the court's history. Justice Alvin came in just shy of 20 years. He's the sixth overall. Something that is interesting is that sometime in 2024, Chief Justice Rabner will pass. Chief Justice Wilentz is the longest serving Chief Justice in the court's history. And in 2030, I believe in his last few days, if he serves up to age 70, Chief Justice Rabner will just pass Justice Jacobs as the longest serving justice ever, you know, only to have that record completely shattered by Justice Pierre Louis, you know, about 20 years from now.
Right, exactly. We were talking before we started recording about perhaps our most tragic justice, Justice Pierre Garvin, who went onto the court in May of 73 and then died in October of 73, having been elevated to Chief Justice in that short time frame, and how that would have impacted the court. He was, I want to say, 52 years of age, something close to that. I haven't looked it up lately. He would have had a long, long run and was tragically stricken and passed away.
Yeah, it's you know, we wouldn't have had the Hughes Court but for that. So it's one of those interesting historical what ifs. But he spent kind of the summer, the court's off season, as an associate justice for about 2 months, and then got elevated to Chief Justice and passed away about 6 weeks later, I believe, of a stroke. Governor Cahill appointed former Governor Hughes in his lame duck period, and you know, of course, the Chief Justice Hughes is one of the most significant legal figures in New Jersey history. It's interesting to look back at how that played out and how easily it could have happened differently.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm kind of messing up our timeline here a little bit, but you've got, in the next few pages, you've got breakdowns of what we'll call the court, the Hughes Court, the Wilentz Court, you know, the Vanderbilt Court, there's the Weintraub Court. I'm going to just jump, I'll let you go back to it. But the Hughes Court, of course, was the subject, as well as his governorship, of a book by Seton Hall professor, constitutional law professor John Weffing, who was kind enough to let me go to his house in the middle of the pandemic and interview him, with Judge Weffing sitting in the other room reading a foot-tall stack of newspapers. And we got into a nice chat about a case, the Katz case, an important family law case that no one else would really care about. But she had written it, and I remembered it from, you know, the mid-90s or whatever, when she wrote the opinion. There's a couple of the shows where I talked about the book, including an interview. The book is called The Life and Times of Richard J. Hughes, The Politics of Civility. We could use a little bit of that. And so feel free to patronize the book on Amazon and check out a couple of the podcasts, May 16, 2021 and June 22, 2021, where I talked about the book and interviewed Professor Weffing about Governor and then Chief Justice Hughes. I also had the great pleasure of meeting him in college. He came and spoke to our New Jersey politics class at Rutgers, that was run by Senator Bateman, not the Senator Bateman that's around now, but his father, who had run for governor. He ran for governor against Brendan Byrne after Cahill. Yeah, that's what it was. He was the Republican candidate for governor and was edged out by Governor Byrne. But he was a fantastic professor. You know why? He came in, he introduced the class, and then he had guest speaker after guest speaker after guest speaker, and we were wowed. It was Governor Hughes, Governor Kane, who was the sitting governor at the time. He came in with his state police detail, Roger Bodman, who's still around in New Jersey politics, and on and on. It was a fantastic class, and Senator Bateman, rest in peace. He was not looking to give people C's, all right? It wasn't that bad of a grader either. Anyway, let's dig into that politics and partisanship on the court.
Yeah, one thing I did was track, because I think it was helpful to look at that there is this unwritten tradition of partisan balance on the New Jersey Supreme Court that I think is most accurately articulated as being that there will never be more than four justices of one party on the court at the same time, which is the way that Chief Justice Ravner put it in his notice to the bar advising that he would not be temporarily elevating a seventh member when Justice Fernandez Vena retired, because since it has to be the most senior member of the appellate division, that would have added a fifth Democrat to the court, which the chief declined to do. And so I went through and looked through kind of the partisan balance of the court over time and how it's shifted. And you can, you know, it's difficult to come across in the audio only format, but you can see that there's really is a great deal of stability. And, you know, it will occasionally, you know, you get a bounce from blue to red in one justice or another. Historically, it's usually been the chief justice. And then Justice LaVecchia as an independent kind of threw a wrench into things for some time, as far as, you know, no one quite knew what to count her as. And I think she was often considered a Republican by Senate Democrats, but it was ambiguous, I think. So, you know, and now we're, you know, we're seeing the continuation of that tradition today, as Governor Murphy nominated Judge Fischelli, a Republican, you know, in order to maintain that balance for Justice Fernandez Vena's seat.
Yeah, I mean, I hope people will check it out. And it's a fantastic bar graph that shows just what you're saying. It's really been balanced. It's never been terribly out of balance for long, and can swing back and forth 4-3 pretty easily. And then you've got something that I never really paid any attention to: senior associate justices.
This was something that no one should be interested in. This it is such an idiosyncratic point. But a friend of mine once asked me whether I believe he clerked for Justice Patterson. No, I'm not certain, but he had asked me whether she would be the quickest elevation to be the senior associate justice on the Supreme Court in, you know, a little over 10 years since she took the bench. And it turns out she's actually the median. She's not even close. And so Justice Long was actually the fastest. She kind of joined at the tail end of that transition out of the Wilentz court into the Porras court, even though Chief Justice Porras had been on the bench for a number of years before then. And so Justice Long, fewer than 4 years after taking the bench, was the senior associate justice on the court. And then kind of at the other end of that is Justice Albin. Just this year, when Justice LaVecchia retired, Justice Albin had to wait over 19 years to become the senior associate, which was the longest wait. And so it was, mostly like a little gimmicky slide, but it's been found interesting enough to create it, so I threw it in there.
I'm glad you did, because it gave us a term that may not be on the tip of people's tongues, but it's interesting. It's very interesting. And in my perspective from a citizen standpoint is, you know, I want a mixture, right? I want people that are sort of far along in their careers. Like we had Justice Tim Pone served for 4.5 years. You know, I think that's fantastic, as opposed to, you know, having a bunch of justices that are there for 20 and 30 years. I think a mixture is the right way to handle this. And again, I'm not opposing having the younger justices as well. So they will create a longer trail, as we have Justice Pierre Louis will be there for many years. Justice Rachel Wayne Rafter, I should say Justice in Waiting, she would be there for a long time. And then some of the new Justice Fischelli, I think he's in his mid-60s, 62 or 3, I read.
I believe he's 62.
Yeah, so let's still have an 8-year run. So it's not a short run, but it's not a 30-year run.
Exactly.
I think a mixture makes a lot of sense. Also, you know, we've got this whole thing about some of this getting the job on the New Jersey Supreme Court produces a pension for some people, but you don't get a pension if you're there for 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. I would imagine, or you don't get much of a pension versus having. I think the justices have the same rule as the judges, the rule of 80, right? It's a combination of service and your age. When it reaches 80, you're pensionable at the full rate.
I think it's close to that. It's a little bit more nuanced in state court. But I think it's also, I think the other tricky part of New Jersey state court is that, you know, unlike federal judges who get their salary forever, I think they you only max out, I think it's 75% in state court.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's
still
right.
Quite generous.
I remember watching Justice Timpone's acceptance speech, and he was coming out of private practice. Of course, he had been in government for many years and U.S. attorney, et cetera. And his father had always chided him when he became a lawyer, because I guess he had another more lucrative job before he became a lawyer. And he was speaking to his dad, who had obviously passed away, and talking about the pay cut that he was taking to jump onto the New Jersey Supreme Court. So it was a good laugh moment. This brings us to really the founder of the modern court, Arthur Vanderbilt. Again, these I love these pet projects. I had Judge Nelson Johnson come on for a couple of shows to talk about his book, Battleground New Jersey, Vanderbilt, Haig, and Their Fight for Justice. Of course, anyone doesn't, the name Judge Nelson Johnson doesn't jump out to you. The name Nucky Johnson might, and the HBO smash hit Boardwalk Empire might jump out. Judge Johnson wrote the book, Boardwalk Empire, that was then turned into a fantastic a series starring Steve Buscemi, written by and produced by Terry Winter, who was one of the big writers on The Sopranos. So a lot of Jerseyana in terms of the media piece, as well as Justice Vanderbilt, who had a spectacular career as a lawyer representing insurance companies and forced our kind of current court, I say forced it, forced the 47 Constitution and a completely new system of justice from stem to stern in our state. And then, of course, wrote the opinion that says, here's all the stuff that the New Jersey Supreme Court is in charge of. And legislature butt out.
That book was quite incredible, to Johnson's history. I knew the contours of Chief Justice Vanderbilt's career, but he is the parent of the New Jersey court system more than anyone else. And, you know, everything that goes on today still has his fingerprints on it in one way or another.
And his court, you know, talk about the length of his court. And he passed away before hitting 70, didn't he? Yes, he did.
I believe he did.
Well, a little shy, but his court was there for the first, from 48 to 57, it was the Vanderbilt court, and kind of set the parameters of how the court did its business and kind of how it operates. All right. Anything else to say about the Vanderbilt before we move on to the Weintraub court? And just, you know, I've said this before, you know, Vanderbilt, in addition to being a practitioner and a politician, was a scholar, taught law up at Columbia Law School. And moving on to Justice Weintraub, who served for many years as the Chief Justice.
Yeah. And this was kind of no one thinks much about the Weintraub court in those terms. I think he served, I believe it was 16 years or so as Chief Justice, but had a very stable roster of justices, and it continued the tradition that Justice Vanderbilt did. And, you know, along with someone who was there the entirety of the Weintraub court was Nathan Jacobs, who was the longest serving justice of the New Jersey Supreme Court, but he was an associate at Chief Justice Vanderbilt's law firm before he became a judge. And he was really, he was instrumental at the Constitutional Convention of 47 of really kind of putting together the judiciary article. I think Vanderbilt was not at the convention itself. I believe he was recuperating from a stroke at the time. And Jacobs was kind of his right-hand man and his voice and very active there. But then he had an enormous stamp on the court's history. He was there from, you know, during the tail end of the Vanderbilt court through all of the Weintraub court. And then, you know, he was there all the way through part of the Hughes court. That's an interesting part of the history there for a little known figure in New Jersey history.
Right. It's amazing. And as you say, he was shuttling to the Chief's, I think, summer home. I think it was maybe even in out of state, if I have it correct.
I believe you're right. I think it was Maine.
Yeah. So pretty wild. Pretty wild how things got done before there was text messages and emails and so forth. The youth court we started to touch on, and I mean, this isn't my criticism, but you know, Chief Justice Hughes, it was straight out of politics. He was born a politician. He was running for office and ran for Congress and became governor as a long shot, and then second term as governor, and fantastically described by Professor Weffing. Anything else you want to say about, in particular, about the Chief Justice Hughes's era?
I think that about sums it up. He was only on the court for about 6 or 7 years, but he, you know, had quite the impact, and he was a force of nature.
Absolutely. Then we get to the longest serving Chief Justice, who also tragically had to retire just before he would have aged out, Chief Justice Wilentz.
Right, yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, Wilentz had a very stable period where his court, you know, was mostly the, you know, it had very little turnover. You know, you had if you look at that duration of service, kind of everyone on his court is near the top of that list. And so, you had this very solid composition, and, you know, including Justice Garibaldi, the first woman on the court, you know, legends like Justices Clifford, Handler, and Stein. It's funny, I almost want to list the rest of the court as legends because I can't leave out O'Hearn from that list and Pollock. So, you know, they're all just, you know, completely unique and distinct voices in history there. And the Wilentz court was such an active court during its time that it was an interesting period in New Jersey history. Very active time for the New Jersey Supreme Court.
Another fantastic book is written about the Wilentz court by Justice O'Hearn, called What Makes a Court Supreme? And he walks through the years, he walks through each justice's contribution, he refers to some of the leading cases that each justice wrote, and also just a very charming view of how the court operated and how they had fun, and how Chief Justice Wilentz was both the taskmaster and the leader of the fun and the parties and the meals and the get-togethers. Really a very charming book. And I promised to talk more about that book. And then I haven't done that much, but I will fill in, especially if there is a little paucity in opinions. I'm getting close to where I've got all the opinions. I've spoken to all the opinions that came out. We're going to touch on one before we close up. And my brain has clicked in, Joe, the case where Chief Justice Vanderbilt asserted the court's role in rulemaking for the entire court system, Winbury v. Salisbury. There was another Winbury case that Bruce Greenberg had just handled in tax case, like a highly technical, boring tax case.
And I'm like, I remember it because I actually represented an amicus in that case.
Okay, you were in that case as well. I mean, I'm not going to get bogged down in that case. And interesting enough, for insiders, Winbury v. Salisbury, that's the one that Judge Johnson spoke to me and said, I read this when I was a law student, and then I read it, you know, 20 more times just to get acquainted with Chief Justice Vanderbilt and how he wrote this opinion and how that has shaped the entire workings of the court, right through the Poretz Court, which went on for 96 to 2006, and then to the Ravner Court, where you served somewhere in the middle of Chief Ravner's term, maybe early in his term as Chief Justice.
It has unfortunately become very early in the term now. It's funny, I was at a reunion of the chief's law clerks this summer and realized that I was, I believe, the second most senior clerk present, and which was alarming to me. I was from his fourth year, his fourth term on the court, and I don't know how many terms, but he's been there for about 15 years now.
Right. Wow. 15 years, and he can go to 2030.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. He serves out, and it, you know, the interesting thing on this court, I think I'll be interested to see what, after this court closes out, the next Chief Justice comes in, what the history of the Ravner Court will be remembered as. I think it is, they've taken tremendous steps in criminal justice reform on both in, you know, on case law, on eyewitness identification, but also just administrative matters. You know, the rise of drug courts and bail reform. This is collaboration between the legislature and the judiciary, and it'll be interesting to see how history looks back at that. And I hope it certainly, you know, one thing, if you look at the visual timeline of the court's composition, it is unfortunately something that dominated Chief Justice Rabner's tenure, is having to manage these vacancies, first with Justice Wallace's seat, and then I think Justice Long's seat was vacant for some time as well. And now with this latest crisis, you know, there's a lot of appellate division judges filling in for extended periods of time and a lot of turnover on the court, but I think it's still managed to stay very focused and resolute. You know, hopefully we're heading into a decade of some more stability now to close out the Rabner Court.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Nicely said. We teased a little bit at the beginning of one case that I have not spoken about. If you still have your pep and you still have time, let's talk about this case. It's the Crystal Point Condominium v. Kinsale Insurance. You still game for that?
Sure. I'll be quick because it's a straightforward case, but I also, be cognizant of everyone's time.
Well, let me just rebut that, because I was thrilled. I read the case, as I always do. I'll kind of read all the cases and then I'll kind of decide how I'm going to order them. I'm trying to keep the state v cases together and the other cases together. And I said, oh man, this one is so far out of my wheelhouse as a practitioner. And you said, I'll speak to this one that deals with construction defects, default judgment, direct action statute from 1924, mandatory arbitration. And this is a reversal, in part, a reversal by the Supreme Court of the Appellate Division. I thought a thoughtful opinion, because I went back to read it, because I said, let me at least know what I'm semi-asking you about here, Joe. But I'll let you dive in to this direct action statute arbitration case.
Yeah, and in my former life as a class action defense attorney, I always pay close attention to the New Jersey Supreme Court's arbitration cases, because it's starting with Justice Albin's decision in Annalise in 2014, New Jersey has taken a very close and careful, and some would say harsh, look at consumer arbitration clauses. And at a time when the U.S. Supreme Court is expanding consumer arbitration clauses, which often include class action waivers in them, New Jersey has found a path toward navigating a way to narrow that in New Jersey without running afoul the contours of what the U.S. Supreme Court has laid out. There have been a lot of state Supreme Courts that have gotten knocked down by the U.S. Supreme Court for trying to do what New Jersey has done successfully. And so I would always pay close attention to that, because they're interesting cases and they were very relevant to my prior practice. But this is not a consumer case. This, as you mentioned, is an insurance case. And so it's a 5-0 decision by Justice Patterson. It was decided a week after Justice Albin retired. And as you mentioned, it involves what's called the direct action statute, which says that if you have an injured claimant with an unsatisfied judgment against an insolvent or bankrupt defendant, and if that defendant has an insurance policy that's applicable, the plaintiff in that underlying action can file a direct action against the insurer, in which case the statute says that they must proceed, quote, under the terms of the policy for the amount of the judgment in the action, not exceeding the amount of the policy. And so here the plaintiff was the operator of a high-rise residential building or several buildings in Jersey City. It obtained default judgments against contractor, construction and engineering entities, but it wasn't able to, I believe it attempted writs of execution that the sheriff's office wasn't able to complete. And so they sued those defendants' insurers in this action that made it to the Supreme Court. And so there were two questions. One was whether the direct action statute was applicable here. And the second question was that the insurance contract itself had an arbitration clause. And so the question was then, is the plaintiff required to arbitrate because the defendants that originally sued had agreed to arbitrate their dispute with the insurance companies? So the court looked at the statutory language to discern the plain and ordinary meaning and to effectuate legislative intent, as it always does. And here it's interesting because, like you mentioned, it was a 1924 statute that had very little legislative history behind it. And so the first question was there, or the first major question, I should say, was whether there was an unsatisfied judgment against the insured. And here the court pretty readily dispatched that there's prima facie evidence of insolvency when the writs of execution had been returned unsatisfied. And so that threshold question was addressed. So that to me, the meatier question had to do with the arbitrability. The appellate division had said relied on common law principles that a non-party to an arbitration agreement cannot be bound to arbitrate. Arbitration is a feature of contract, and you have to, if you're not a party to that contract, you can't be required to arbitrate. And the Supreme Court said, yes, that is the common law rule, but here there's a statute that says the plaintiff is standing in the shoes of the policy, quote, under the terms of the policy in the language of the statute. And so here the terms of that policy include arbitration. And so plaintiff stands in the shoes of the insured, and if the insured had to arbitrate, then a plaintiff suing under the direct action statute has to as well. And so that is Bristol Point versus Kinsale Insurance Company.
Well, I appreciate you did nutshell it way better than I would have been able to, and I appreciate that. And we would call this a reversal, as we were talking about your statistics, right? We would call this a reversal. However, the insurer, Kinsale, sort of won to force the plaintiffs pursuing money judgments to arbitrate. And the plaintiffs also won because they were able to move on under the direct action statute, because the disappearing defaulting defendants, even though they would have no particular knowledge about their insolvency or bankruptcy, just that they weren't able to find money, right, in the post-judgment collection process, that was sufficient to keep the case alive under the direct action statute. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, that's right. This is an example of one of those cases where the statistics don't tell the full story, because there's, both sides won and lost.
That's right.
Here. So everyone walks away upset.
And finally, if you read these cases, you get to see the shape of where New Jersey policy is going from the Supreme Court standpoint. And oftentimes you'll get a vocabulary word. And I had to look this one up. And it's spelled S-E-Q-U-E-L-A. And I'm thinking of my old high school teacher, Don Burstein, who also trained as a lawyer. Passed away, rest in peace. And he would say, well, break it down. And it's like, well, sequel. So I'm going to pronounce it sequela, I assume. And it was in the appellate division opinion, essentially describing the binding arbitration clause as a sequela. In other words, an after effect of a disease, condition, or injury, as described by Webster's. So they're saying to these plaintiffs, we're not going to make your injuries worse by making you arbitrate and making you subject to the arbitration clause to which you never signed on to. But alas, the plaintiffs are stuck with this sequela. All right, Joe, unless there's anything else you want to jump into, I want to again thank you. We went way longer this time, but it just becomes more and more interesting, and everything you've done here is such a service to the folks that are interested in this, and hopefully this helps push it out a little bit. And I very much appreciate your time, appreciate your efforts. It's a real service.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm glad someone finds this as interesting as I do.
All right, we're gonna sign off. Everybody, thanks for listening to the Bold Sidebar. We'll see you next time.